All right, welcome to another deep dive. Today, we're going way back to 1887, to be exact.
Ooh, 1887. Going way back. What have we got?
We're diving into a Supreme Court case called Mugler v. Kansas. Even though it's, well, pretty old, it still matters a lot for how we understand things like states' power, individual property rights, stuff like that.
I like it. Property rights, state power, 1887. Sounds like a recipe for some serious legal drama.
Oh, it definitely is. And, to really set the scene, we got to picture America right after the Civil War. The temperance movement is gaining a ton of traction, like a huge deal.
Right. Everyone's trying to figure out how to deal with alcohol. And the 14th Amendment, which is still pretty new at this point, is kind of shaking things up in terms of who gets to decide what the states or the federal government.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, what did Kansas actually do that landed this whole thing in the Supreme Court?
Okay, so Kansas basically went all in on prohibition. In 1880, they changed their state constitution to ban the manufacture and sale of, quote, intoxicating liquors. And then, just a year later, they passed a law to really put some teeth into that ban. It became a crime to make or sell alcohol with very, very few exceptions. Like, you could still get it for medicine or for some scientific uses, but that was about it.
Whoa. So it wasn't just about shutting down saloons. They were going after the whole production side of things, like targeting the breweries themselves.
Oh, absolutely. This wasn't just about where you could drink. This was about stopping alcohol at the source.
Gotcha. So let's talk about the people at the heart of this case. First up, we've got Peter Mogler.
Ah, yes, Peter Mogler. Now, he owned a brewery in Saline, Kansas, had it since 1877, so it was a well-established business by the time all these prohibition laws came along.
Right. So he was there before the ban and just decided to keep on brewing.
Seems like it. Maybe he thought his existing business would offer him some kind of protection. I don't know. But ultimately, he kept going, kept brewing and selling his beer. And, well, he got arrested and convicted for breaking those new laws.
Oof. So he's looking at fines, maybe even jail time.
Potentially, yeah. Now, the other big name you're going to see in this case is Siebold and Hagelin, another brewing company in Kansas. But their story's a little different, right?
Yeah, it seems like the state went after them in a slightly different way.
They did. Instead of going with criminal charges, Kansas decided to hit Siebold and Hagelin with a civil lawsuit. They wanted the court to declare the brewery a common nuisance. And if they got that declaration, they could actually shut down the entire operation and even destroy the property itself.
Wait, hold on. They could actually destroy the brewery, like demolish the buildings and everything.
Potentially, yeah. That's what abatement could mean in this situation. And the really wild part is this could all happen without a jury trial.
Wow. Okay, so Mugler's facing possible jail time, and Siebold and Hagelin are looking at the state potentially bulldozing their business all because of beer. It seems pretty extreme, right?
It does seem pretty extreme. And that difference in how the state approached these two cases, that's something that really bothered Justice Field, as we'll see later. But ultimately, both Mugler and Siebold and Hagelin were fighting the same basic battle against these Kansas prohibition laws.
Right. So let's get to the legal meat of this case. What was their main argument against these bans?
Well, they hung their hats on the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, which, basically says that states can't deprive someone of life, liberty, or property without due process of law.
Right. One of the big ones.
Absolutely. And both Mugler and Siebold and Hagelin argued that these prohibition laws were basically taking away their property without any compensation, which is a big no-no. They had these perfectly legal businesses, they invested their money, and then boom, the state changes the rules, and those investments are basically worthless.
Like the rug got pulled out from under them.
Exactly. And in Siebold and Hagelin's case, the state was even going a step further and trying to physically destroy their property. Plus, they argued that the law was so broad that it didn't even allow them to brew for their own personal use or even to sell to other
So
states.
they're basically saying, hey, this isn't fair. We had legitimate businesses, and now the state's just taking our stuff without following the rules.
That's the gist of it, yep.
Okay, but I mean, the state must have had some justification for these laws, right? It wasn't just about hating beer.
Oh, of course. This is where that idea of police power comes in. Kansas was basically saying, look, we have a duty to protect our citizens. Alcohol is dangerous. It leads to crime, poverty, all sorts of problems.
So they're arguing that they're just doing what states are supposed to do, protecting the health and safety of their people.
Exactly. Police power is kind of a catch-all term for the authority that states have to make laws and regulations for the well-being of their residents.
So we've got this head-to-head. Brewers saying their property rights are being trampled, and the state saying they're just trying to do their job and protect people. What did the Supreme Court ultimately decide?
The court ended up siding with Kansas big time. Justice Harlan, who wrote the majority opinion, basically said that states have a lot of leeway when it comes to regulating stuff they see as harmful.
But that can't mean states can just take people's property whenever they want, can it? There has to be some limits, right?
Oh, absolutely. And this is where it gets really interesting. The court made a super important distinction between the state regulating how you use your property and the state actually taking your property for their own use.
Okay, I think I'm following. So if Kansas wanted to take over Mugler's brewery and turn it into, say, a public school, they'd have to pay him for it, right?
Exactly. That would be considered a taking. But in this case, they weren't taking the property itself. They were just saying, hey, you can't use this property to make and sell alcohol. They were regulating a use that they considered harmful, not seizing the property for their own purposes.
Ah, okay. So kind of like how the state could pass a law saying you can't dump toxic waste in your backyard. They're not taking your yard. They're just saying you can't use it for something dangerous.
Exactly. Perfect analogy. And in Mugler, Justice Harlan actually wrote something really important about this whole idea of property rights.
Oh, yeah. I remember that line. It was something about an implied obligation.
Yeah. He said that all property in this country comes with an implied obligation that the owner won't use it in a way that harms the community. So, you know, your right to own property isn't absolute. It has limits. If your use of that property is hurting others, the state can step in and say, nope, not going to happen.
That makes sense. But I'm guessing the court didn't just give states a blank check to regulate anything they wanted under the guise of police power, right? There had to be some kind of checks and balances.
Yeah, you are right. The court made it clear that they weren't just going to rubber stamp any law a state passed under the name of police power. They said that courts can and should step in and strike down laws that don't really have a good reason for existing. Like, if a law is clearly just trying to mess with people's rights and has no real connection to public health or safety, it's out of there.
So it's not enough for a state to just say, we're doing this for your own good. The courts can actually look at the law itself and decide if it's legitimate.
Exactly. And this idea that courts can look at the substance of a law, not just the procedures for how it was passed, that became super important later on. It's a big part of what we call substantive due process.
Right, right. Okay, so the majority sided with Kansas, but not everyone on the court agreed with that decision, did they?
No, not at all. Justice Field wrote a pretty scathing dissent. He really wasn't happy with how things went down.
Yeah, I remember he had some serious concerns about the part of the law that allowed for breweries to be destroyed, especially in Zybold and Hoglund's case.
Oh, yeah. That really rubbed him the wrong way. He basically said that destroying those breweries was way too extreme. He saw it as straight-up confiscation, not just regulation.
Yeah, he had that one line that really sticks with you.
Mm.
Something about wanton destruction, right?
He did. He wrote, "Abatement must be limited by necessity, not wanton destruction." He felt that the state was going too far. They weren't just targeting the harmful activity. They were going after the property itself. And for him, that was a dangerous precedent. Like, if the state can just declare your property a nuisance and destroy it without really proving anything, what's stopping them from doing that to other kinds of property, too?
It's like a slippery slope argument, right? Like, where does it end?
Exactly. And Field also raised some concerns about the state trying to regulate the manufacturing of alcohol that was intended for sale in other states, which he saw as potentially overstepping their bounds in terms of interstate commerce. But the core of his dissent, the thing he was most worried about, was the way the state was using this nuisance law to potentially destroy people's property without due process.
It's wild to think that a case about breweries in Kansas from the 1800s is still relevant to us today. But it really is, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. Mugler really set the stage for a debate that's still going strong. The balance between the government's power to regulate for the common good and the individual's right to own and use their property.
And like we talked about earlier, it also played a key role in shaping that whole idea of substantive due process, which is still being used to challenge laws even today.
Big time. So, you know, when you hear about modern day legal fights over things like bans on flavored vapes or limits on sugary drinks, it's all coming from the same questions that were at the heart of Mugler.
Like, how far can the government go in the name of public health and safety? Where do we draw the line between protecting people and infringing on individual rights?
Exactly. It's all about finding that balance. Mugler basically says, yes, property rights are important, but they're not absolute. The community's well-being matters too, and the state has a role in protecting that. However, and this is crucial, the state's power to regulate isn't unlimited, and courts have a duty to make sure they're not abusing that power.
So, in a nutshell, Mugler v. Kansas is a reminder that we're always trying to figure out where individual liberty ends and the common good begins. And that's a debate that's probably never going to go away, right?
Probably not. Which is why cases like Mugler are so important to study. They give us a framework for thinking about these really tough questions, even if the specifics of the case of, you know, breweries and beer might seem kind of old-fashioned.
Totally. So to wrap things up, here's a final thought for you to ponder. Given the court's stance in Mugler that they'd scrutinize the real relation of laws to public welfare, how do you think that principle should be applied in today's world? You know, with all the regulations and complexities we're facing now, it's something to think about for sure. Thanks for joining us for another deep dive.
Always a pleasure.